entered into the land of Canaan itself. And chapter 13 deals with the division between Abraham and Lot and Lot's choice of the plains of Sodom. Chapter 14 is the chapter that records the battle of the kings and the experience of Melchizedek. Chapter 15, Abraham still hadn't had a seed yet after some years, probably maybe 10 years had passed. And chapter 16, finally somebody was born, but it wasn't the promised seed. This was Ishmael. And that tells us, to that point, to the birth of Ishmael, the end of chapter 16 says that Abraham was 86 years old. And since Abraham was 75 when he entered the land of Canaan, we've gone for about 11 years from Abraham's experience in Canaan itself. Now, when we get to the next group, we have skipped about 13 years of unrecorded history in Abraham's experiences. And in chapter 17, finally, it's about time for the promised seed to be born, and so Abraham is circumcised, and he's promised that he would have a child, and the next year, that child is born. But the next year, also, or actually in connection with this experience, there was a destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and that takes up two chapters, 18 and 19. Abraham then goes down briefly to visit the Philistines in the city of Gerar, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And in chapter 21, finally, Isaac, the promised seed, is born. Now, all of that you see from chapters 17 to 21 takes about a year in duration. So while we have about 11 years in the first category and then a 13-year gap, the next category is just a year of narrative. And we skip then many years, all the years of Isaac's growth, until it's time for him to be offered in the mountains of Moriah. Now, how old was Isaac at that time of his proposed sacrifice? Well, we don't know exactly. I have read it. Some brethren have a great interest in making him 33 and a half years old, if you understand the appeal to that, but there's no evidence particularly. However, right after that, you have the record of the death of Sarah at 127 years old. Now, she was 90 years old, 10 years younger than Abraham, when she bore Isaac. So certainly Isaac could not have been older than 37 years old at this point. And some Jewish tradition actually speculates that it was the pain, emotional pain Sarah underwent with the potential of having Isaac taken from her in death as a sacrifice that led to her death. Now, we don't know that that's fact, but it is a very pronounced Jewish tradition. If there's any credence to that tradition, then Isaac would have been in his 30s. And that means there would have been a long gap between section 2 and section 3 on our outline. But whatever, however that may be, chapter 23 records the death of Sarah. Chapter 24, after Sarah's death, records Abraham's wish in his old age to find a good bride for his son Isaac. And I think you remember the story. Eliezer was sent back to the land of Haran. We'll get back to that in a moment, to find a bride from the family line. And one was found. That was Rebekah. And finally, after Rebekah and Isaac are married, chapter 25 records that subsequent to this, Abraham took another wife, Keturah. And a few verses later, the death of Abraham is recorded at the age of 175. That's the narrative. Now we're going to go back and look at just some pieces of this narrative. Not comprehensively, it would be too long of a lesson. We're going to start in chapter 11 itself, where it discusses the family of Abraham. Now, chapter 11 actually gives you the family lineage all the way from Shem, starting with verse 10. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And you can trace generation by generation all of the links of genealogy from Shem down through Terah in this 11th chapter. And then we read in verse 26, that Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So Abram had two brothers. There was Nahor and Haran. Now, since Terah at this point was 70 years old, we know that although it lists Abraham first, Abraham was not the firstborn. It's somewhat similar to when we have described for us the sons of Noah earlier. There was Shem, Ham, and Japheth in that order in the narrative, but certainly not that birth order, because as we learn elsewhere in Genesis, Japheth the elder apparently was the oldest. Ham the younger apparently was the youngest, and Shem was midway. And therefore, the order of announcement of these three is not the order of birth. And likewise here, Abraham was going to prove to be the most prominent individual in this family, and therefore his name appears first. Nahor is going to join Abraham on his trip, we'll see in a moment, and therefore he's put next. And Haran, actually put last, was actually the firstborn. He was the oldest of all, and we can tell that when we go a little further in this narrative. We find that Haran actually was the father of Nahor's wife, and possibly the father of Abraham's wife as well. We'll see in just a moment. But let's go back now. How do we know that Abraham wasn't born when Terah was 70 years old? Well, we know this way. If you look at the last verse of this chapter, in verse 32, it says, "The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." And after that, when Terah dies in Haran, then Abraham takes the opportunity to go southward into the land of Canaan. And we read in chapter 12 that Abraham, in verse 4, was 75 years old when he left Haran. So he left Haran when his father died. His father was 205. Abraham was 75 then, do a little subtraction. Terah was 130 years old when Abraham was born. So Haran, his older brother, was like 60 years older, 60 years his senior. Now, let's go back and look at these family members in chapter 11 that are actually involved. It says in verse 28 of chapter 11 that Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. So clearly Haran did not join this family campaign to the west. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran. And then it just repeats the same thought. You know, you wonder sometimes what such repetition, but it's helpful when you're trying to figure things out. That is, Haran was the father of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, and the father of Iscah. Who in the world is Iscah? We don't hear about her anywhere else further in the narrative of Genesis. And it is Jewish tradition, but again, it's tradition, that Iscah was another name for Sarai, and therefore this is Sarah. If that tradition is true, then Abraham and Nahor, both brothers, married both of them, the daughters of their elder brother Haran. So you can see the generational gap involved. Now, later on, is this credible? Later on in the 20th chapter of Genesis, and I think about verse 12, in the experience where Abraham goes down to the area of the Philistines, and it wasn't the only occasion he did this, he told Sarah, "When we get into this area, there's people that we don't know how good they're going to be, and you are a very attractive woman," and she was, dear Sarah always was, and says, "I want you to tell them that you're my sister rather than my wife. So if they, you know, have any problem with me being your husband, they won't kill me." So she did, and the ruse worked, and actually God struck with a plague of barrenness all the household of the king of the Philistines, Abimelech, and his household. So finally the truth did come out. Sarah was really his wife. And Abraham explains, "Well, you know, I wasn't exactly telling you a mistruth. She really is my sister, half-sister, that is. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother." Oh, no, how could that be? "The daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother." But if you notice here, in Genesis, the 11th chapter, it says, Terah, in verse 31, "Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law." Now, if she was really his daughter, wouldn't it just say his daughter? Instead, it's his daughter-in-law, suggesting that maybe Sarah was his daughter once one generation removed. If that's true, then she was the daughter of one of the sons of Terah, and therefore it leads to the suspicion that maybe she was the daughter of Haran. That's where the concept in Jewish tradition comes, that she was the daughter of Haran. Now, whether that be true or not, we don't know. It is also probably true that the mother of Haran was not the mother of Abram. There were 60 years between them. And probably the same person that bore children to Terah, like Haran, probably was not the same mother who was still of childbearing age when Abram was born. So there's various options, and we'll just leave that as it is now, but go on. But the point we want to emphasize is that this was very much a family affair. There was a family of faith God was calling. And this was, they were all linked, and more than, we often say the truth among us is relative, you know, because we're sometimes intermarried. But here it really was in a very strict sense. We're going to look now to chapter 12. It says that the Lord had said to Abram, "Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that curse thee, and curse him that curses thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." Now, we don't have a record of when Abraham was told that by God. We don't. All we have is a record here that previously he had said that when they were way back in Ur of the Chaldees before they ever left. So you get the idea that Abraham is responding to this and leaving his family. And his, not quite. He left his native birthplace, but the family came with him. Now, we understand by chapter 11 that Terah came with them because it was after Terah died here that Abraham came down. Well, who else came? Well, Haran didn't come. He was dead already. But Lot did, Haran's son, and Sarah, of course. But not recorded here is the fact that Nahor, his brother, also came with him. You will find that when you get to the end of chapter 22, after the proposed sacrifice of Isaac. Then a few verses ending chapter 22 say, "At that time," which is years after this experience, "Abraham heard the news that his brother Nahor, up in this area, had had children." He had, as a matter of fact, 12 children. It's as though they had been incommunicado for several decades, and now he hears the good news that they have been productive as well. But Nahor stayed in Haran when Terah died, and Abram alone with Lot and Sarah came down into the promised land after Terah was dead. So now Abraham has come into the land. He's left his father's home. He's left his native birthplace. So now it's time to fulfill that promise that was made back in Ur of the Chaldees. And so we read in verse 6, "Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem and unto the plain of Morah, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him." Now there's the place where many brethren say, "Oh, that's the place where he actually made the covenant." Before it was a proposition. If you do this, then I will make my covenant. Now Abraham has done that, which was required. So God appears and says, "My covenant is with you." He made the covenant. Now there's other options for choosing the place of making the covenant, as we'll see later in the narrative. But this is the first where God says, "Now my covenant is with you." Now it's interesting, this is the place of Shechem. Now, we have an S here for Shechem on our map. This map is not in scale, but to give you some rough idea of where these places are. They had left Ur way back here on the river Euphrates. This is the river Tigris. They both empty into the Persian Gulf. The river Euphrates actually was going to be the northern boundary of the Holy Land, as described later on. But Haran was on the other side of the river, so it's still in Mesopotamia. Meso, between the two rivers. That's Mesopotamia. So when Terah was dead, they crossed there. They've come now into the promised land, come to the place of Shechem. That's where God makes his covenant. Now that, by the way, in all these places that they're going to go to early on, remind us of the place where later, after Israel came from Egypt back into the promised land, when it was time now for the promise to give Abraham and his seed this land, time for that to be fulfilled. Now they come back into the land. They cross the river Jordan, capture Jericho, Ai. Then they go up to Shechem, where they are brought into a resolve and a determination to keep the law of the Lord. You'll find that in Joshua, in the 8th chapter. We're not going to turn there and read it. We'll just refer to it for your notes if you wish. Joshua 8, 33 through 35. So the place where Abraham is told to go, goes and receives the covenant, is the place where Israel later came back into the land to receive the confirmation. Now that also is the place where it's kind of a valley area, where there's two mountain tops that are nearby. Those are the things we've indicated in red. I think you probably know the names of those mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And that's where the blessings and the curses of the law were read, blessings from one, curses from the other. And all the people heard the words of the law, and they said, "Yeah, we agree, we're going to do it." And so they're committed. It's as though after this long period of time, after the 40 years of wandering, when they first received the law, they come into the land, and now they all collectively, that generation says, "Yes, we'll do it." They're brought into the covenant of the Lord, or have it renewed again, as it were, the same place where the covenant was first established with Abraham. Now, if we go a little further, in Genesis, the 12th chapter, oh, by the way, and years later, before Joshua was ready to depart the scene, He took all of Israel back to Shechem. And he says, I'm old, I'm ready to go. But I just want you to know that you should worship the Lord your God with all your heart, and I want you committed to this. He says, think about this. And they all made a commitment, a very firm commitment to follow the Lord wholeheartedly. You'll find that in Joshua 24, 24 through 25. Well, back to Genesis 12 chapter. Verse 8 says, He removed from thence unto a mountain on the east side of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he builded an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. This position of Ai is also remarkable in Israel's entrance into the land. After crossing the Jordan and taking Jericho, they next took Ai. That was the next city they took, and they burned it, which is very unusual. They usually did not do such a thing. They burned Jericho and Ai and another city called Hazor. Most of the other cities they didn't burn. They took them for their possession. And so the points that Abraham is visiting here are significant later in Israel's history as well. In verse 9 we read, the Abram journeyed going on still toward the south. And as a matter of fact, most of Abraham's experience in Canaan as a sojourner was in the south of the land. He went south farther, down to Bethel, and ultimately to Beersheba. Now in this episode he's going all the way down to Egypt because there's a famine. But he comes back and most of the life of Abraham is going to be lived in this area of the southland rather than the north of the midsection, although he traveled in all of it. But we'll go on to chapter 13. Chapter 13 describes in verse 1, Abraham went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had and Lot with him into the south. And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and in gold. He went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel, the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai. So he's coming back out of Egypt, and he goes as far north as Bethel, as Bethel and Ai, and between those two areas. And that's where he builds an altar, and he resides there for a while. Chapter 14, we're going to skip. That's the episode of Melchizedek, and you all know about Melchizedek. We've all been through that recently. Chapter 15, Abraham still, after all these years, about 10 years in the land, he's about 84, 85 now, he still has no seed. He has no son. And he begins to wonder how this is all going to come to pass. He's getting older, and he wants some assurance from the Heavenly Father that he will have a son. And so the Lord says, yes, I will give you an assurance. And in verse 5, he's brought him forth abroad, and he says, look now toward the heaven and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said, so shall thy seed be. Now it's interesting that on several occasions the patriarchs had affirmed to them how large their seed would be. Abraham was told that his seed would be, in chapter 13, like the dust of the earth. And in here, that his seed would be like the stars of heaven. In Genesis 22, when Isaac was offered, he was told that his seed would be like the stars of heaven and the sand of the seashore. As we go through each of these expressions, which are kind of idiomatic expressions common to the day for expressing vast multitude, we'll find that these expressions are used in a very discreet and very distinct way. When God had the subject of the land at issue, like in chapter 13, when he said, look now to the west, the east, the north, and south, and see all the land that I'm going to give you, he said, your seed will be as the dust of the earth. When he's talking about Isaac, he says, your seed is going to be like the stars of heaven. Now, who does Isaac represent? But the seed of Abraham, the spiritual seed. And therefore, it's the heavenly realm. When he's talking to Jacob later on, Jacob, by contrast with Isaac, would represent the earthly seed. He says, the dust of the earth. Your seed would be like the dust of the earth. When he's talking about the earthly, it's the dust. And we propose that when he talks about Jacob, the earthly seed, he means his literal earthly seed. That would be natural Israel. Natural Israel is the ones that are going to receive the land for an inheritance. Talking about the land, it's the dust. Talking to Jacob, it's the dust of the earth. Talking to Isaac, it's the stars. Now, when you go to Genesis 22, and Abraham has offered Isaac, and God has accepted it, even though he didn't have him kill him literally, but he's accepted it, because it was obvious Abraham was ready to go through with it. Then God says, now your seed is going to be like the stars of heaven, spiritual, and like the sand of the sea, the broadest expanse. And the sand of the sea, I think, represents the whole remainder of the world of mankind that ultimately would be brought in to be part of the seed of Abraham. See, you've got three designations for the seed. Stars, spiritual. Sand, the multitudes of the sea class, you know, that later will be the earth class in Revelation. And now, and then for natural Israel, it's the dust of the earth. Those three different expressions are used very peculiarly to the patriarchs. Now, by the way, when you get to Revelation 20 and at the end of the 1,000 years, and Gog and Magog are unleashed to go out and deceive the nations if they can, it says they gather this great multitude, the number of whom is as the sand of the seashore. Now, how will there be so many deflectors at the end of the 1,000 years as to number them as the sand of the sea? Well, there's two answers. One is that if there's a very small proportion of the billions of humanity, it will still be a large number. That's possible. The other possibility is that if the deceived are not numbered as the sand of the sea, but the host of mankind that he goes out to deceive are as number as the sand of the sea. If so, that's an intriguing way of showing the same thing here. The whole world of mankind will be the seed of Abraham, but it's the sand of the seashore. The natural Israel, that's the dust of the earth, and the spiritual is the stars of heaven. At least it's a consistent picture. Consistent picture does not prove it's the intended picture, but at least there's no proof that it isn't, you know, if you had an inconsistency. And I think this really forms a very nice key. By the way, there are three designations to the seed of Abraham. How many women were involved in bringing forth children to Abraham? Just three. There was Sarah, the spiritual seed. There was Keturah, the earthly seed. And there was Hagar, natural Israel after the flesh. And maybe there's a parallel with those three women and these three designations. In chapter 15, a very peculiar chapter, if we go by the customs of our day, Abraham is asked for some assurance that he's going to have this promised seed. Now, as Tim mentioned yesterday in his talk about when he referred to covenants, today, when men make a covenant, they drop a contract and parties sign it and there's a guarantee. But in these days, covenant policy was different. Now, they often had a covenant feast, like Brother Cooper referred to yesterday. There was another method that was similar to that, and that was what is described here. The two contracting parties will take an animal, kill it, divide it in pieces, put the pieces laid out on the ground, and the two contracting parties will walk between the two pieces as though to suggest, we are so bound by this contract that if we don't fulfill the terms, may it be that we'll be cut apart like these pieces of the sacrifice. That's how strong it was, like a blood oath, as it were. Now, you'll find this specifically referred to, this method of covenanting, specifically referred to in Jeremiah 34, I believe it is, about verse 18 or 19, where God says, remember the people of Israel were ready to be taken away by Nebuchadnezzar, and they thought, what can we do to avoid it? I know. We'll release all the captives and we'll proclaim a sabbatical year. We've got to do something. Maybe this will appease God. And guess what? It worked. They all took an oath. All the princes of Judah lined up and they walked between the pieces of the calf. And God did have his anger appeased and he remitted the siege. And when the siege was remitted, their hard hearts said, oh, well, we're out of danger. We'll go back and take our captives again. And so God chastises them. You have broken the covenant that you made when you walked between the pieces. And for that, he caused Nebuchadnezzar to come back, take the city, and they all went captive. So this is what God is condescending to honor, this form of a covenant of securing. But in this place, you notice that Abraham did not walk between the pieces of the sacrifice. We read in verse 17, it came to pass when the sun was down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. What passed between the pieces was a shining lamp representing the divine presence and a smoking furnace representing trials and tribulations. Elsewhere, the experience of affliction in Egypt is referred to as the smoking furnace of affliction that Israel would pass through. And so what God is telling Abraham is, first by the divine presence walking between the pieces, he's saying, I am covenanting to fulfill my word to you. Now, Abraham didn't because he's already done what was required of him. So that's why we call this a one-sided contract, a unilateral covenant. And therefore, God obligates himself here, not both contracting parties, because Abraham is now merely being affirmed that God will do what he has promised. But in this chapter also, it was told Abraham that all of the fruition of inheriting the land is not going to happen right away. Verse 13, he had said to God, Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, and afterward they will come out with great substance. And that 400 years affliction was signaled, typified by this smoking furnace that accompanied God's promise of a future assurance. So this is the great covenant, and in verse 18 we read, "In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham," literally cut a covenant, and through this means of sacrifice, "saying, unto thy seed I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates." That would be the river of Egypt. This sometimes it's called the Wadi El Arish down in the Sinai. All the way up to the river Euphrates, the extent of the promised land, he says, "I'll give it to you all." And he says, he lists all these countries that are going to be his possession. He lists them all, and you count them all up, there are 10 peoples, perhaps representing the 10, like the 10 toes of the image, a picture of complete things with respect to the earth. All the families of the earth, then, are going to be his possession, ultimately, blessed by Abraham. Remember, the subject of chapter 15 is Isaac, the spiritual seed. Isn't it true that the spiritual seed of Abraham is going to inherit and bless and uplift all the families of the earth? And I think this promise typically is saying the same thing. We go to chapter 16. Chapter 16 is the time when Ishmael is born. After this great assurance God had given Abraham, and Sarah thought, well, maybe God is expecting something of us to do something in light of the facts that I'm barren. And so Ishmael is born, and in verse 16 we read Abraham was 46 years old at that time. Chapter 17, Abraham now is 99 years old. 13 years have passed. This is the chapter in which Abraham is told to be circumcised, and it's as though God is saying, now I'm getting ready to give you the promised seed. First step, circumcision. So the seed comes out of a circumcised Abraham. And the covenant symbol of circumcision is administered here. You'll find that in verse 10 referred to. And at the same occasion, this was the time that Abraham's name was changed. In verse 5, it says, "Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram," which means father, "but Abraham," which means father of a multitude, because now he was beginning to have the first step taken in producing a seed that would result in him being the father of a multitude. Now, Sarah's name was also changed. Sarah's name in the same chapter was changed from Sarai to Sarah. Now, the word Sarah is easy to understand. It's the word Ser or Sar, which means prince, with a, which is feminine. So it's a feminine prince, which, as you know, would be a princess. And Sarah, the princess that would be the princess of Abraham, the father of all nations, is just a fitting, beautiful name for her at this time. What does Sarai mean, her old name? That's not so easy to figure. There have been different opinions on what the meaning of that name is. One is that it refers to contentious and kind of a disposition that's not quite as pleasant. If that's what it means, then it's certainly nice to have this change of name, which was such a lovely change to make. Others dispute that and suggest that the name Sarah meant something like dominative, or somebody in control, like Tsar would be a prince. And it's either way, it's a very lovely change of name that's given to her. Now, at this time, I think you remember that God had not revealed to Abraham and Sarah his name that he revealed himself to Moses later on, Jehovah, or Yahweh, the 4 consonants that you can pronounce a variety of ways. However, it's interesting that the name change that was brought to these two, Sarah and Abraham, both involved the significant letter that appears in that name of God, which would be later revealed. Now, the thing that was added to Abraham's name was the letter, in our language, we make it the letter H. In Hebrew, it would be the letter Heth, which is the 5th letter of the alphabet. And Sarai was changed to Sarah by also the addition of the letter H. Now, how do you spell the name of Jehovah? Well, in our language, I'm going to delete the vowels, which we just supply, because they weren't in Hebrew. It's something like J, or sometimes people say Y, H, V, H. So if you had to use one letter to represent the name of God, it would be H. And that's the letter that was added into both of their names. as though to affirm that this covenant-keeping God, which later would be known to Moses as Jehovah or Yahweh, I will be what I will be to fulfill my promises, that letter was put into the names of Abraham and Sarah. Now, was that intentional, you know, for this purpose, or was that this a coincidence? I think it's for this purpose, but you make your own judgment. You have the facts. And so many of these things, you can look at the evidence and then see, well, was that God's design or was this a coincidence? But it's that is the letter which would stand for God's name. As we go on to chapter 18 and 19, we see the experience with Sodom. We're going to pass that by. And when we get to chapter 20, we have Abraham journeying down to the south to the Philistine area and to the city of Gerar. And that's where he says that Sarah is my sister, and we've referred to that passage already in verse 12, where he explains this relationship. Chapter 21. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bare Abram a son in his old age, and he at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abram called the name of the son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. And Abram circumcised him on the eighth day. And Sarah said in verse 6, God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. Now, the reason she says this, of course, is that the word Isaac means laughter, as I think you remember. Now, there was laughter associated with the birth of Isaac on a few occasions. There was laughter when it was announced that there would be a birth of a son in their very old age. Sarah was, 89 when she heard that news, and she laughed. And the angel says, "Now you laughed, didn't you?" "Oh, no, I didn't, no." He says, "No, you did." But here, however that laughter was intended, here, this laughter is for joy. This is a laughter of joy that, oh my goodness, in my old age, this is so delightful. The promised child is born, and all that hear of this will just rejoice with me. And I think that's the real reason why Isaac was named Laughter. Now today, you may hear the same name in Israel pronounced a little differently than we're accustomed to. It's Yitzhak. Yitzhak Rabin as Isaac. And I often wondered, why aren't any of the Jewish people named Isaac today? Well, it's because it's Yitzhak, and they really are, but we just don't catch it so often. Chapter 21 is also the experience where Abraham now has to make a decision to expel Ishmael. He doesn't want to at all. In fact, even when it was announced that Isaac would be born, Abraham fell on his face. He laughed as well, I think probably in joy and appreciation for what was going to happen. But he did say, oh, what about Ishmael? Oh, that Ishmael may live in your sight. And God says, don't worry, I've heard you about Ishmael. He'll be a great nation as well. I'll favor him as well. But now, a few years later, when Isaac is born and Ishmael is mocking Isaac, now Sarah is just enraged and she says, I want this woman out. It's not the first time that Hagar had fled. When Hagar was pregnant, she had to flee because Sarah had a change of heart and she was treating Hagar pretty roughly. Find that in the earlier chapters. And Hagar fled. And then she was near death, and the angel of the Lord preserved her and said, go back to Sarah, your mistress, and humble yourself and just subordinate yourself to her. Just do that, and it'll be well with you. So Hagar did. Now this is not Hagar fleeing. This is Abraham told by God to condescend to Sarah and put out this child. It was a grievous thing for Abraham, but he was very faithful, and he did what God said. And so he expelled them. And of course, this provides a type for us that Isaac, who represents the spiritual seed of promise, supplants any promise to Ishmael of being the promised seed. And so by comparison, natural Israel is cast out of God's favor during the gospel age because they are not Israel, they are not the spiritual seed. But they are still to be blessed. And in this experience in the wilderness, Hagar is ready to die again, and her son's ready to die of thirst. And finally, the angel points out the well of the oath, the well at Beersheba, which is the well of the oath. And they're refreshed, perhaps suggesting that all during Israel's cast-out condition, they are, you could say, near death. They're famished for food and water, but they are preserved. And at the end of the age, they are preserved by the well of the oath, God's promise that he would preserve Israel, natural seed of Abraham. And today we've seen that. We've seen Israel come back to life. And we see in the future when they breathe the breath of faith again that they will be God's people in the kingdom on earth. That is the focal point of God's administration from which, under the rulership of the ancient worthies, the blessings of life and health and instruction will gradually flow out to the whole world of mankind. It's a very practical point with respect to the needs of mankind. When you consider people in America, well, they have a Christian heritage, they know something about Christianity and God and Jehovah, but think about most of the world that have not been under the influence of Christianity. Most of them, well, the kingdom is coming. People in China are going to say, well, so what's this all about now? Who's this in charge? And one thing they will identify, the God of Israel is the one who is the God of this kingdom. They will identify through the nation of Israel the history of God's leading, his dealing, who he was, what he did, the Messiah that he brought forth in due time. Everybody will have this touchstone to recognize whatever this is, it's the God of this people of Israel. So we're going to go there and find out what this is all about. It's a touchstone, a way of understanding what it's all about. I think it will also tell the world of mankind, this is not the God of Christendom. Now, it is the God of Christ in Christianity, but this isn't the God of hellfire and torment. It's not the triune God. They won't identify this, oh, this is the God of America. This will be the God of Israel, Jehovah, the ever-existing one, the one who brought forth Christ the Messiah, whom Israel had rejected for so long. They'll recognize it's not for Israel's sake he does this, but for his own name's sake. And they will truly be able to have a touchstone to come up and worship the Lord. And in Zechariah, the 8th chapter says, 10 men out of all languages and nations shall take hold of the skirt of the Jew and say, whoa, we've heard that God is with you. And they will go up and worship the Lord at Jerusalem. That's a very practical way for the world of mankind to have access to the kingdom. I don't think it's going to be a flash overnight where the whole world says, well, now we know exactly what to do. No, it's going to be a process. It's going to take some time to bend those thoughts and minds and hearts. Political entities will not be dissolved immediately. There'll be some work involved in this. But for Israel, what a blessed opportunity for them to realize humbly first that they have forsaken their Messiah for 2,000 years. And so this people now exalted as the center of God's kingdom. They're exalted not in pride, but in humility, in weeping, and in mourning, as they mourn for him as one mourns for their only son. It's as Paul said, everybody is going to be humbled first, and then used, and then be made a blessing. And by the way, it's ourselves as well. We all have the chief place if faithful unto death. But we will have learned through this life the lessons of humility so that we realize it's not because we were wonderful or noble or great, but chiefly the poor, ignoble things of this word, the base things, as he called, so that the majesty of God can be exhibited, that out of the poor dust of the earth he has called even us, mixed it with the spittle of his word, and made us the eye salve for the world of mankind and the kingdom. All through humility, there will be no pride involved here in God's arrangement. Well, we pass on now to chapter 22. 22 is the sacrifice of Isaac. And this was in Abraham's advanced age. And in verse 2, it says, take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. Now, it wasn't an arbitrary place. Take him wherever you like and sacrifice him, but specifically on the mountains of Moriah that I will show you. And I think you recognize that it was the mountains of Moriah that the Temple of Solomon was later built, as the establishment of God's place in Israel, where the atonement offerings were given year by year. As though to show that this offering of Isaac was a picture of the same thing as those atonement offerings would be, the sacrifice of our Lord giving his life for the world of mankind. Now Abraham rose up early, it says in verse 3, and on the third day he lifted up his eyes and he saw where he was. Remember, they were living down in the south country near Beersheba, and they came up to the city of Jerusalem, where Mount Moriah, that wouldn't be the city of Jerusalem then, but that would be about the area of Salem, where Melchizedek had been. But in this area, in the mountains of Moriah, that's where they were going to offer. So it was about 3 days' journey up there, it indicates. Now, Isaac is a little confused, but it says in verse 6, Abram took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took fire in his hand and a knife, and they both went up together. Kind of reminds you of what happened to Jesus. Jesus bore his own cross to Calvary. The wood was laid on his back, and he carried it up that hill. And Isaac says, well, now, here's the wood, here's the fire, but there seems to be something missing here. And Abraham says, God himself will provide a lamb for a burnt offering. And that lamb, of course, turned out to be Isaac. Now, you know the story. You know that later, after God stayed the hand of Abraham they saw a ram caught in the thicket. That's not a lamb. That's a ram. What about the lamb that he was going to provide? That lamb was Isaac. The ram was not a substitute for Isaac. The ram, just like in the tabernacle, was a burnt offering that showed the acceptance of the previous offering. Remember when there was a sin offering in the tabernacle, there was a sin offering of a bullock and a goat, and after each one there was a burnt offering of a ram to show that God had accepted the offering that had been given. Now there may be other features of type involved in the burnt offering than that, but at least that's included. The burnt offering is God's way of accepting, showing his acceptance of an offering. I think that the point is here is God has shown that he had accepted Isaac as an offering. Even though he stayed the hand, it was fully accepted because of the intent of Abraham to follow through. And as Hebrews says, Abraham received him in a figure from the dead because it was a figure of how Jesus would be received from the dead by the Heavenly Father many years later near the mountains of Moriah. This is the greatest extent of the blessing that we find in Genesis 22 when Abraham had done this. Verse 15 says, "The angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, 'By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because you have done this thing and has not withheld thy son, thine only son, in blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven spiritual and as the sand of the sea, the whole race of mankind. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice.'" This was the great covenant oath that he took, that Paul refers to in Hebrews, that he, by two immutable things, the word of God, he told Abraham he'd do it. But now by the oath, by these two immutable things in which God can't lie, we can have a firm assurance that this promise will be brought forward. Absolutely unquestionable. Now, you remember in the book of Daniel and the prophecy about the 70 weeks, talking about the Messiah? One of the things to be done was to seal up the vision and the prophecy. And that occurred by the death of Jesus to confirm all the visions that Daniel had been receiving. Well, here's the great seal to the vision and the to the covenant, to the visions that Abraham and the promises Abraham had received, finally given to assure this blessing. Now, at the end of this chapter, in verse 19 forward, they return to Beersheba, where they normally dwelt during this period of time, way down in the southland. In verse 20, it came to pass after these things, it was told Abraham, saying, "Behold, Milcah, that is the brother of Haran, Milcah has borne to your brother Nahor all these children." You count them out, there's 8 kids, and then her handmaid supplied 4 more children. There's 12 children involved here. Can't help but wonder if maybe here there's another reference to, just like Ishmael. Ishmael had how many children? 12. Ishmael pictured Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel's 12 sons. Maybe here also is a secondary picture of showing how we have the seed of Abraham now, guaranteed here. We have the sacrifice of Christ. We have the stars of heaven referred to. Ultimately, they'll have it everything. But now we've got a reminder that in addition to the stars and the whole world of mankind, there will be this natural seed of Israel, the 12 tribes, that will be brought forward, a kindred to the Abrahamic covenant, to the covenants of promise. His brother that brought forward those. That's possible. It's interesting that at least the children involved here are the same as with Ishmael, just 12 in number. Chapter 23, Sarah was 127 years old and she expired. Abraham refused to accept gratis the burial plot for her, but rather insisted on paying the 400 shekels, remembering that God, who said they would wander for 400 years, would be faithful to give them all the assurance of his promise. And perhaps this 400 shekels was evidence of his faith that after the 400 years, all of the promises of the land would be given to his seed. Chapter 24. Abram was old and well stricken in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Abraham was fabulously wealthy. He had we learn from earlier chapters, and probably this time many more, probably at least 1,000 people in his entourage with untold herds and flocks and gold and silver and jewels and precious things. He was very wealthy. But he now wanted something, additional of the Lord. A bride suited for Isaac, the seed of promise. And so he tells Eliezer, Eliezer's not named here, but we suppose it is because earlier in the narrative, Eliezer is named as his servant. He tells Eliezer to go back into Haran, to where Nahor, his brother, had been. Nahor now has had a son named Bethuel, and Bethuel had a daughter named Rebekah. Now, Abraham didn't know all that, but he knew that somewhere in this family, he'd like to get a bride for his son Isaac. So he says, go back there and take a bride. So Eliezer goes on his way. He passes quite a distance. Must have taken some weeks to get up there. And he's very tired and very ready for an answer to his prayer. And we read now in verse 13, behold, I stand here by the well of the water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. And he's praying to God. He says, let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee that I may drink, may that be the damsel that you have shown me. And it says in the next, as it came to pass before he had done speaking, Rebekah came out that was born to Bethuel, and this damsel, verse 16, she, as the New American Standard says, she was beautiful. You know, Sarah was quite lovely. I guess it ran in family. And when Eliezer sees this beautiful damsel,